Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. We're joined this week by my colleague and friend, Carrie Weber. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's very good to be here.
Carrie is the managing editor at America and also author of a new book, very exciting, Mercy in the City. Give us the rest of the title.
The subtitle is a little lengthy. It's called How to Feed the Hungry, Give Drink to the Thirsty, Visit the Imprisoned, and Keep Your Day Job.
Well, this is Loyola Press that published it, and this is your first book, correct?
Yeah. Well, there's a short book of prayers that I published in 2009, but this is my first sort of book, as we've been calling it, that has a narrative and a kind of a, you know, some heft to it. So it's exciting.
Now, mercy is obviously a big theme here. It's in the title. You've written about it for us before, but obviously this is a deeper exploration. You were a mercy associate when you got out of college. So was that kind of your first introduction to this, the charism of mercy?
Well, my first introduction was as a mercy volunteer, after college. And so, yes, that was sort of the first time I sort of experienced mercy as a charism rather than sort of mercy as something that you give or have in a single instance. And it sort of sunk in over time that this was something that was important and meaningful to me through my year as a volunteer and then through my interactions with the Sisters of Mercy in the meantime, and then later when I came here to New York as a Mercy Associate, which is sort of the lay super friends of the Sisters of Mercy.
Okay, so you're a volunteer first, and then when you came here, you were made associate just in the last year or two, correct?
May of 2012, yes. They have it's what's called a covenant signing, which sounds a little bit like maybe you use your own blood or something, but it's really just sort of representing that sort of mutual support that a covenant implies, in that we sort of pledge to try to live out values of ministry and prayer and service in our lives, and the sisters pledge to commit to helping us to do that. So it's sort of this really nice relationship that's created.
So how did it go from, you know, your experiences with the Mercy Sisters as a volunteer, as an associate, to writing a book about it?
Sure. Well, sort of a couple things happened simultaneously. One, I was writing an article for America here at the magazine about Father George Williams, who was the prison chaplain at San Quentin State Prison in California. And as I was doing that research, I sort of started looking up information about Catholicism and prisons and service, and up pops a list of the corporal works of mercy, which had been very familiar to me as a product of Catholic schools, sort of in theory. But as I sort of started reading the list, I realized that in reality, I was not literally doing many of the things on the list. And so what I wanted to do was to try to challenge myself to complete these works of mercy over the course of about 40 days. And this, during the story, it happens to take place during Lent. And to try to incorporate them more fully into my life and see what I could learn from them, but to try to also do it authentically and in a way that builds relationships both with people around me and the city and with God. What I wanted to avoid was kind of doing it as a stunt or as some kind of one-off example that I never really returned to or never really incorporated into my spirituality. And so it happened that simultaneously Loyola Press had approached me to write potentially about Lent or about service, and it all kind of just came together, and I saw a chance to really use that season as a backdrop for the kind of change and transformation that I hoped the experiment would produce.
Well, just for those out there who's thinking of reading this is not, you know, it's not just a dry exploration. It's a fun story of you living in the city and your friends and your experiences. And one of the good stories you have here is about your pancake. Is the pancake spectacular? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the Sunnyside Pancake Day Spectacular.
All right. And what is that?
It's my annual party that I've held on Mardi Gras. This Lent will be the fifth year that I've held it. And pretty much anyone and everyone is welcome to come to my house. And the first year that we had it, I was looking up Mardi Gras traditions, and I came across this Pancake Day celebration, which is held in Ireland and England, I think, traditionally, where they would use up all the sort of rich ingredients to make pancakes and rich foods before Lent began. So the way my party works is I provide the pancakes, and if you want to come, you can bring anything that you're giving up, or just anything that's convenient. So we end up with a lot of six packs and a lot of pancakes, which works out pretty well for everybody. If you give people free pancakes and beer, they will come all the way out to Queens. So
now you tell the story in your book of before you started going through and doing the corporal works of mercy, you had this event. And when you started telling your friends about it, what was the reaction you got?
Yeah, well, I think, so my Lenten sort of practices were multifaceted. There was the corporal works of mercy. There was, I was planning to give up sweets. I was planning to give up alcohol. And I was planning to go to the Stations of the Cross twice. I think I figured since I'm going to do something, I'm going to go all in and we're going to see how this goes. And hopefully they'll all kind of be integrated in a way. And I kind of thought my friends would be like, oh, the corporal works of mercy. What are those? But mostly my one friend was like, don't give up beer. You're going to die. but I actually am not that big of a drinker. So that was not too big of a sacrifice for me. But it did make some like social interactions interesting when you have to explain that to other people.
Now, the corporal works of mercy, where is the biblical origins of that? Is it in one of the Gospels?
Sure, yeah. It's in Matthew, most people would attribute it to. And Jesus says, you know, whenever you do one of these things to the least of my brothers, you do them to me. And I think, you know, we say that a lot, but we don't really always make that connection in real life. When we see a person who seems homeless on the street, or we see someone who is hungry or really in need, it's a lot easier, especially if you see people like that a lot, especially in New York. It's easy to sort of become numb to that and to not think of these people as people, even, never mind Christ-like. I think part of my experience was sort of actually just learning to see people as people, no matter who they are or where they were, in a way that was really meaningful, and not necessarily saying, everyone is, like, all the homeless people I see are either crazy or Christ-like. You know, you don't canonize them and you don't criminalize them. Just interact with people as you would interact with anyone.
Yeah, that part I think is something definitely a lot of people can relate to, especially those who work or live in the New York area. What do you do when you encounter a homeless person, somebody on the street? I've lived in New York most of my life, and you're right, you get into this zone where it's like you don't interact, because part of it is coming from back when New York was not as safe as it is now, and you just, for safety reasons, you just kind of kept your head down.
Right.
But so what was your, you know, how do you approach those situations now as a result of this experience?
Well, I think I'm very sort of, I'm much more conscious of it now. And I think I'm much more, I try to be more present to people, even if it doesn't mean that I'm always able to, like, pull out my wallet at 2 a.m. and fish around and find some money to give to some, you know, like, there's these lines that you try to walk that are, how do you stay safe as a single woman in New York at coming home at 1 a.m. or something, and how do you take the risks that Christ asks us to take? And because the life of a Christian is meant to have some risks involved, and so it's easy to use that, to use sort of fear as a wall, and to never react to anything and say, well, it could be unsafe, I'm never going to do anything. And so even just on the subway a lot, you might find someone who's homeless who is sleeping across several seats or something like that. And, you know, people will all push to opposite end of the car and no one will be on that car. And to try to, I'm near that person, and to just sort of even just look someone in the eye instead of running away. In the everyday life, I try to do those little things.
Yeah, to recognize their humanity. Now, it reminded me of a quote from Francis about, you know, go out there in the streets and life should be messy, and that, you know, take those risks. You also have another great quote here. I think it's from Father Jim Keenan, that mercy is the willingness to enter into the chaos of another. Well, that seems to be a great definition.
I think so too. And I think the thing that I sort of took away from reading that quote and from my experience is that it doesn't mean you're not bringing some of your own chaos as well. It doesn't mean entering into the chaos of another once your own world is peaceful and calm and perfect. It means, okay, I'm going in and I'm taking what I've got with me and whatever experiences I have and whatever preparation I might have made, and trying to be willing to again be present there within their experience, and, you know, bringing some of your own.
Now, you write in the book about some of the, you know, the difficulties of going through this, that not every morning did you feel like in the mood to for example, you were going to a homeless shelter. You spent a couple nights there, correct?
I spent a night there. I'm not a morning person. So this was a very challenging project for me because, as I said in the books, it seemed like trying to do God's work was taking place only at ungodly hours. It was, the homeless shelter that I stayed at everyone, you know, everyone goes to bed at 10:30, but then, you know, you're in an open room with 15 people or so, and people get up and there's coughing and people move around, and I don't even go to bed at 10:30 usually, so it seems early and I couldn't fall asleep. And then we're all up again at 5:30 in the morning. And the bread line that I volunteered at started at 7. I volunteered to bring to hand out water at a half marathon. That was, I had to be at Central Park at 5 a.m. So again, these are not major, you know, on the scale of suffering, that's pretty low to have to get up at 4 a.m. or something. But for me, it was definitely a challenge, because it presented this challenge of how do I find that balance of not being so exhausted from whatever I was doing in the morning that it was really, you know, starting to detract from the rest of my life, or how do I serve God and, you know, do these service projects without...
Yeah, keep your day job.
Yeah, and keep my day job. Exactly. It's a very apt subhead. Yeah, so I didn't get fired. So spoiler alert, I'm still here.
But you write frankly about it, like there were times you felt burnt out. I mean, it was difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really, it was tiring, because both physically and because sometimes being present is tiring. It's easier to check out. It's easier to kind of zone out and not be present to people and to kind of say, all right, I'll be here and think about what I want to think about, and then I'll go home and I'll just sort of, you know, go through the motions. But to get up early and to be present, you know, it can be an effort.
Now, one of the things I liked about your book is you kind of lay out these, you know, these basic commands we have. The carpal works amount, you feed the hungry, clothe the naked. But it also made you think about these basic things in your own life, like clothing choices and what that says about you and what it says about, you know, all of us. It's maybe you could talk a bit about that part of your book.
Sure. Yeah, I think most of my friends would describe my fashion sense is quirky is really the word that comes up. So I sometimes, you know, I was in Catholic school uniforms for 13 years, where your biggest choice was, do you want to wear the maroon polo shirt or the white polo shirt? So it was, and I kind of, you know, people complain about it, but I loved it because it was just this great sort of this thing that I didn't have to think about at all. So as I've moved away from school uniforms, I've obviously acquired more clothing. And what the project really got me thinking about was how much of that do I really need? And so I went through and pulled out the items that I didn't think that I needed, and I put them in a bag, and I don't know, it was maybe a dozen items, and I was feeling kind of proud of myself. And then I went to what the Catholic Worker Clothing Room on the Lower East Side, where on Tuesdays they invite women in to sort of pick and choose from clothes that are sort of arranged almost like a little store in a room. At Mary House, at the Catholic Worker. And after sort of talking with those women and seeing the needs of the women and seeing sort of clothes fly off the shelf and realize how much they needed to be replenished, I kind of went home and went through my closets again and came up with, you know, another 24 items or something, you know, a good number of items where I would look at it and think, you know, if someone at Mary House asked me for this, would I really try to keep this? And that's sort of the question is that sort of, is that St. Basil quote of the, you know, the cloak you have in your closet belongs to the poor. And so I, you know, I was able to kind of rethink my accumulation of quirky clothing. However much they want to wear it, that's another thing. But
well, it challenged you in a way that, for example, giving a sweater you haven't worn in 5 years is not that hard to do. But mm-hmm. to actually, you know, to take that quote seriously and say, okay, I'm going to go in my closet and find something nice that, you know, this person right. might actually want, you know,
right.
that I might actually want.
Right. <It's harder>. Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it's looking at clothes where I think I could wear this again.
Right.
You know, I could totally wear this and I might get some more use out of it, but do I need it? Do I need 4 sweaters that I could totally wear again? Maybe not. Maybe I only really need 2.
And you took that, do you take a similar approach to thinking about hunger and the other issues that you encountered while doing these corporal works of mercy?
Yeah, I tried to sort of be creative and realize it, you know, that part of it is trying to do these things literally, and part of these is sort of trying to figure out what it means for you spiritually and to look at the ways that people sort of feel hungry or naked or thirsty for other things in life, and the ways that you can kind of help to fulfill those needs as well.
Now, did this experience, these 40 days, did you find, even though at times you were maybe got burned out, did it also give a certain order to your life, a certain purpose?
Yes. And that was, I think, really interesting, is that when I, for me, I was really surprised actually that when, even though I felt busier than I had in a long time, I felt more purposeful, and I felt like it was the good kind of tired, the kind of tired where that you feel when you are sort of, you know, doing good work or you've exhausted yourself for others, and not the kind of tired you feel when you've stayed up till 3 a.m. watching Breaking Bad. Even though I love Breaking Bad, and sometimes that's a good kind of tired, but most days I would rather have, you know, the next morning have another hour of sleep than know that, like, plot twist.
So when you were finished, what happened that was kind of unexpected? You know, what were the kind of lessons you learned?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting to me that one of the works of mercy that within the book, I think, was the hardest to think about was the burying the dead. And so there were several ways that I tried to do this, and I got some sort of not so friendly emails from the Department of Corrections when I wanted to go out to Hart Island and there's a Potter's Field out there, and I wanted to bury dead with the inmates, and they thought that was a bad idea. And, you know, so there, I had tried to go about it a couple different ways, but what an experience actually after the book was finished and after I was done with my writing was actually really powerful to me, which was that my sister gave birth to a child who passed away the same day. And we held a funeral for her, obviously, and to be able to put that event into the context of mercy as I had sort of, as I had experienced it and as I had sort of meditated on it, gave that event a lot more meaning. It was not just a ritual or just a kind of thing we had to do. It was to see it as a work of mercy and as something that theoretically can bring you closer to God and closer to each other helped me through the mourning process and helped me to see it as sort of, yeah, just to see it as a more meaningful event than I think I would have had I not thought about these events throughout this process.
Well, that was a powerful moment, and this book is dedicated to your niece.
Yes, to Marian Elizabeth Begley.
Now, I just want to end, this is sort of America, well, not quite America gossip, but part of, you write about Father Bob Collins, who's sort of a quiet force here in the magazine, but very important to what we do. Maybe you could talk a bit about him and how he kind of shaped some of your approach to these issues.
Sure, yeah. Father Bob Collins is, in addition to being an executive editor here at the magazine, is the director of religious education at St. Paul the Apostle Church here in Manhattan. And a couple years ago, he recruited me as a sponsor for the RCIA program, though, which is over there, which is the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults. So part of the book chronicles my experience as a sponsor in RCIA with other young adults who have chosen to enter the church and our process in that. And so part of what I get to write about is some of the words of wisdom that he offers throughout that process. And I don't know how he is able to be both sincere and sarcastic and like hilarious all at once, but he's such a welcoming force in the church and a really positive example and role model for so many of the young people entering the church and really relatable. So it was nice to be able to sort of chronicle our experience together outside the magazine as well as, you know, work with him every day.
Yeah, and it's so important to remember those people like Father Collins there's so many of them in the church who you may not hear about, but are play such an important role in the faith lives of average Catholics. And it's good every so often to give them some attention.
I think so, yeah. I told him I'm going to make him a star. So we'll see I don't think he actually likes that very much. He's pretty quiet and humble.
Yeah. Well, again, Carrie, good luck with this book. It comes out on February 1st.
Yes.
Correct? But you can get it now digitally, I understand?
Yes, it's available on Kindle now, okay. On Amazon.
Well, we'll put links up to Loyola Press because they'll have all the links there. And good luck with it.
Thank you very much.